to Feminists Without Mystique, a podcast where we process politics, sex, and the unrelenting fire hose of bullshit in the news through an unapologetically feminist lens. Each week, we vent about the news, go deep on one important issue, call out terrible things happening below the top headlines in a segment called We See You, and then we'll end with something hopeful. Yay!
Yay!
And a reminder, if you're liking us, to subscribe, to follow us on the social medias, tell any friends or fam that you think might be into us, and do it.
Yeah.
Do it.
Do it.
Do it. Impeachment things, proceedings, began today, and so next week we will address that.
Yeah. They're still in the process of figuring out the rules.
Yeah. And
I made a real point of not checking in too many times today because the headline was just all day on CNN. You know, it was I'm trying to think of the right word, like mind-boringly.
Numbingly?
Mind-numbingly awful. Just trying to update people on all of the different trickery that Mitch McConnell was imposing.
Yeah. Slithery little snake.
He's literally, at one point was trying to say that the proceedings could only, opening remarks could only be 2 days and like 12 hours each, which would just mean that we would be literally in the dead of night deciding things, which is like just so openly evil.
Yep.
But I'm sure that, I look forward to talking about it. I don't look forward to it happening.
For sure. And it got moved to 3 days.
Yeah.
Because I guess even some GOP people were like,
Yeah.
Which gives me a little hope.
I mean, all they want to do is make it look as quote unquote legitimate as possible. Yeah. I'm feeling very cynical.
But hopefully with them trying to make the appearance of that happen, it actually becomes more legit.
That would be cool.
Grasping for all the straws.
Yeah. There was, I think, my boss sent me this Onion article that was Susan Collins makes her, spent 4 hours deciding what to have for lunch and ended up deciding she'd have exactly what Mitch McConnell was having. She was thinking about quinoa, but then she ended up getting roast beef on rye or something. And rye's too interesting. It was roast beef on white bread.
Ugh, Susie.
Yeah.
Love the Onion.
Yeah.
Onion reductress. Good for all our satire needs.
Yes. So that's happening. Yep. Yesterday was Martin Luther King Day.
So we're going to be talking about some, first of all, spoiler alert, we're not post-racial in America.
No.
There's still racism.
Yeah.
What? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So we're just going to be talking about some of the kind of racial disparities and racism and all these things that are happening in the U.S. of A. today.
And we recognize that we are, both white women talking about it. And after we talk about a couple of recent things that have been making headlines, we're kind of going to go back and forth with just like items that are just deeply racist.
Yeah.
And hopefully it'll give people a lot to think about because a lot of these things I just sort of... they're easy to sort of go under the radar or ignore if it's not directly happening to you. So hopefully it'll just be an informative.
Yeah, a little eye opening. And I think people have a tendency, certain people have a tendency to blame black people for problems that have arose based off of systemic discrimination and oppression.
Yeah.
But
just it's a not, vast history of structural inequities.
So we're gonna dive in.
But before we do, I think it would be so good for everyone to also just acknowledge, the nuanced perspective of Kellyanne Conway.
Oh God,
who spoke yesterday, saying that Martin Luther King would not approve of this whole impeachment process against Trump. He would think it was ridiculous.
She knows.
She knows. She also shares a birthday with, I guess, this day, and she said she's proud of that. And yeah, it was just
so uncomfortable.
All in all, a really grotesque showing from her, but that's what we can expect. And
yeah. And
amazing.
pretty amazed that Kellyanne Conway is, I don't know if she got a Ouija board or what, sort of giving her this insight into a man who was, you know, on record as being against these kinds of things.
Yeah.
All of a sudden,
yeah,
you know, would be supporting the president.
Can you imagine?
She knows. Kellyanne, she knows.
She speaks from, you know, the heart and from experience.
And from her experience as a black woman.
Oh my God. Ugh, gross.
She just, like, God, like, so many of these people just, like, the more things they say and the more time that passes, it's just, like, the worse you realize they are. Even when you already knew they were awful, and then this shit comes out where they're talking about what Martin Luther King would have wanted. Good Lord.
How do you do that? Oh my God.
Ignorance.
Well, we thought we'd start today talking about a big article that came out last week in the New York Times.
NYT.
About the differences with in textbooks when you compare the U.S. history textbooks from the same publisher, McGraw-Hill. You compare the textbooks in Texas to the ones in California. The same textbook, talking about the same historical events. And it's pretty telling.
It's bonkers. They're very different.
Yeah.
And it's kind of bizarre that how different they can be. And, like, in the way that it's decided what's going to be in these textbooks is, like, they have state boards of education that appoint people to panels, and the panels decide. And so in California, they have educators on the panel.
What?
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Which is bonkers. And then the Texas panel has some educators, but also parents, business representatives, and Christian pastors and politicians.
Okay.
So, so that kind of sets the stage. Ugh, can you guess which one's more close to the truth? I mean, in my liberal biased opinion.
And I think that looking, we'll get into some of the details of these because they're pretty egregious. But this is a microcosm of, I think, when we talk about racism in America, some of the things that it's really hard to necessarily articulate without a specific example or without like being able to explain exactly what you mean, because people say like, oh, well, it's basically the same thing, you know, these two events. And this gets at the fact that, like, not only do words matter and the way that you describe something matter, but, like, what you choose to omit, the context you choose
to give. Cherry-picking history.
It's really, it's pretty crazy. And to think that Texas has this outsized influence on public schools, because 1 in 10 public school children actually go to school in Texas, which...
It's a big place.
Big! And that we, as a country, have really rejected much nationalization, or I guess like federal regulation of what students learn. It's very much controlled by states. And so hence we have the perfect thing to talk about, which is textbooks in Texas versus California.
Yes. And so one of the kind of, like, glaring examples of how race is treated differently / misrepresented in Texas. So they, after the Civil War, like, when talking about Reconstruction and housing discrimination and all that jazz, in the California textbook, they talk about how white people in the South resisted the Reconstruction because they did not want black Americans to have more rights. And then the Texas book says it was because reforms cost money, and then that means higher taxes. And then also things about housing discrimination, like redlining and restrictive deeds, are in the California editions, and they're just not even mentioned in Texas. It just didn't happen. Like, they have, they're very, the Texas books seem to be very all about Christians and white men who did stuff.
Yeah. In the Texas textbook, they're looking, they highlight the influence of Christianity a lot more.
So much. Weird they have a pastors on the board.
Right. It's
Church state.
You know, California tries to also outline, you know, when they're talking about certain figures, they talk about if they're an immigrant or if they're a Jewish immigrant, or, you know, trying to highlight the diversity that already exists.
Yeah.
And really, like, bring it into the conversation so that people become aware.
Right. Because, I mean, textbooks have historically been kind of had a lot of erasure of non-white, non-Christian sort of figures who existed and did well. And there was also this the section that had, like, different cliff notes and stuff, and they're talking about people like Langston Hughes and other black poets and authors and things. And the Texas book said something like that some of those people, like, critics kind of argued about whether or not they're actually, like, good.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Why would you add that?
That was disgusting. That, and I think, like, yeah, there was the whole section on the Harlem Renaissance, and to say, to make, to the pettiness and the, like, to add that critics, quote, dismiss the quality of literature produced.
Why are you?
That's really... The Second Amendment, there's an annotated Bill of Rights in these textbooks, and in the California textbook, there's an annotation next to the Second Amendment to say that it has allowed, that rulings on the Second Amendment have allowed for gun regulations. In the same place in Texas, the textbook only contains a blank white space. There's no annotation about regulations.
No, not in Texas.
They also, I mean, I think housing regulation is a big one because not only is it not highlighted during this during Reconstruction, but it's not highlighted when they talk about the New Deal and when they talk about suburbanization in the 1950s. California requires children to understand that housing discrimination against African Americans was a huge thing that is still affecting wealth inequality today. And in Texas, the books say that this that housing was not accessible to African Americans because there was congestion and crime, and they're using, like, all this coded language to basically say that, like, to explain away white flight, and they purposefully leave out these details about how certain New Deal era programs were not available to African Americans. And that was, as it's been largely pointed out, one of the most prosperous times in the in U.S. history where there was significant upward mobility, but that was only for white people, and it was directly due to government handouts.
Exactly. And so then white people were able to prosper and do better, and black people were having a hard time finding anywhere to live.
Right.
You know, and they couldn't live where they wanted to, and it obviously has ramifications today, you know.
Yeah.
People always say, like, oh, slavery, oh, that stuff. It was all so long ago, but these things don't exist in a vacuum.
Right.
Like, things that happen, all of these things that are put into place, and these laws and these loopholes, some of which still exist today, just because some of them have gone away doesn't mean that the effects don't still very much linger.
Right.
You know, you think about how wealth is passed down family to family and all that jazz. So racism is real.
Yeah, I think I had this in my notes for later, but the median white household's net worth is 16 times that of the median African-American household. That does not exist in a vacuum.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, it's like, it's quite bonkers.
But if you're not learning about this, like, if you're not learning even the language of housing discrimination and thinking about, like, for instance, the New Deal as government programs that involved like handouts.
Yeah.
You're not going to understand. Who could blame you for not understanding the world that we live in now?
Yeah.
You're at a disadvantage.
Right. And it's like when you're a kid, for the most part, like you just kind of, when you go to school, you just kind of believe and trust that like you're learning the not only things that are true, but like you're understanding the big picture.
Right.
And so when you have this sort of half true education, or this true, but with glaring things left out or misrepresented, then these kids grow up and become people that believe these things. And, which I think we all just need to research everything all the time.
Yeah.
To figure it out.
Yeah.
You can't trust the system. And it's and also puts such a burden on teachers in Texas who want to teach the right content, you know, and they have to go out of their way to kind of add other educational materials to what they already have to kind of fill in the gaps. And, you know, teachers are already overworked and underpaid, and to not have reliable texts for them to use. And then on the flip side, those teachers that are like racist or shitty, you know, they have this to lean on. They can just cherry pick other things to back it up further. And it's just really fucked up.
Right. I mean, yeah. if you're given a textbook that doesn't insist that you bring up, like if you're not, yeah, it's really, it really encourages a narrow reading and a narrow understanding of U.S. history, which is really too bad, because there's a lot that everyone should know about U.S. history, but also, as I think a lot of us learned with Hamilton, but also if you had a good U.S. history teacher, which I did, it just like jumps off the page and becomes like heartbreaking and interesting and complicated and all of the things that the world is today. It always has been that way.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we're not doing our kids any favors by leaving out the true and messy things and teaching them that white people are great. Yeah. Look at us go. Like, sometimes black people have a hard time, but that's, like, kind of their problem, you know? Yeah. Like, we're just, like, wonderful white people.
Yeah. And we must work harder. That's why the wealth is greater concentration.
Because we work harder, even though, like, those numbers you talked about with the insane wealth gap, like, that's after adjusting for, like, education and things like that.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, the argument does not stand.
No.
So cool.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about moving kind of from textbooks to the Supreme Court for a second. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're lucky and you have a really good teacher, you have a good class, you could learn the history of race as it's been represented through the Supreme Court, which is fascinating on its own. Brown versus Board of Ed was a case in 1954, which said that it reversed a ruling that said separate but equal is equal.
Yeah.
And Brown v. Board of Ed said that is unconstitutional and separate but equal is not equal. Mm-hmm. So the way that that's relevant literally right this instant is more than two dozen of President Trump's judicial nominees that have been approved by the Senate have declined to answer whether Brown v. Board of Ed was properly decided.
Yeah. Which is absurd. And they say, like, they have their excuses. They're like, oh, well, it's dangerous for me to say anything about any cases that have already happened, but that's also not a precedent. People do state their opinions. Even Kavanaugh said Brown versus Board was like a great thing.
Right.
Even fucking Brett Kavanaugh said it. And all these people, they didn't say that they thought it was wrong, but they wouldn't support it.
Right.
And yeah, like more than two dozen people that he wants to go on to be judges, federal judges.
I mean, it's chilling. It's, like, it's slippery. It's a real problem. And also, like, if you're thinking about, you know, whether or not to vote, you should vote just for the courts, because that's what conservatives have been doing for so long.
Yeah.
And any judicial nominees who are tiptoeing around this, I think, like, I would be comfortable, like, in the future trying to go back to them and get an answer. And I think there are certain things that would be fair for you to demand, like, an affirmative response on the ruling about the humanity of other people. Anyway, so that's just another thing that I think, with all of the shocking things happening, it's easy for that to kind of go by the wayside. But it's important to remember that that's, like, that's happening.
That is very much happening.
Very much.
Like, let's not, you know, take it back to 1954. No. Make America great again. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
That's what you mean.
Yeah.
Just dog whistles. Cool.
It is.
Cool. We also wanted to mention Meghan Markle. Angel from the Heavens. And just sort of, I mean, as we all know, unless you've been under rocks, she and her bae are, they've moved to Canada to kind of, in large part, get away from the racist media attention that she's gotten. And it was BuzzFeed that sort of, which isn't like the number one source for news, but these are like real things that they showed. They showed kind of the discrepancy between reporting about Kate Middleton and Meghan Markle. And just like a couple of these. So Kate Middleton, there are pictures of her holding her baby bump. Kate Middleton is a white woman. And it says, not long ago, pregnant Kate tenderly cradles her baby bump while wrapping up her royal duties ahead of maternity leave. And William confirms she's due any minute now. Aw, that's nice. Meghan Markle, pictures of her holding her bump. Why can't Meghan Markle keep her hands off her bump? Experts tackle the question that has got the nation talking. Is it pride, vanity, acting, or a new age bonding technique? I'm sorry, what?
What?
And then this is like maybe my favorite. I mean, it's awful, but it's like, what the fuck is this? So Kate Middleton, Kate's morning sickness cure. Prince William gifted an avocado for pregnant Duchess.
Oh my God.
And then Meghan Markle's beloved avocado linked to human rights abuse and drought. Millennial shame. Just like,
it would be funny if it were a parody.
Yeah,
you know,
it's real, and like there are more examples of that that y'all can. Oh, and then one more.
Yeah,
from Kate Middleton's wedding. There's a beautiful photo of her with like her floral bouquet, and it's why you can always say it with flowers. A floral code popular in Victorian times is making a comeback thanks to our royal newlyweds. And then the other one. Royal wedding, how Meghan Markle's flowers may have put Princess Charlotte's life at risk.
Oh, yeah. That was a stretch. That was a real stretch.
It's just like, God, Meghan Markle and her dangerous avocados and flowers. And why is she touching her baby bump?
Oh, my gosh.
The thing that, like, literally all pregnant women do.
Yeah.
And why?
Oh, my gosh.
So it's just these criticisms of her as this outsider, you know, which, you know, yes, she's American, but methinks it has more to do with the fact that, you know, she is a black woman.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, so glad she's out of there.
Yeah.
Go live your life.
I know. Go for those beautiful walks. She looked so happy.
Oh, thank God. She deserves it.
Yeah. Oh, it's just...
Oh. It's just the ladies.
But, yeah, I mean, and that was sort of, like, racism that I was kind of aware was happening, but also we just didn't really understand and just thought, you know, maybe... Because we weren't reading the Daily Mail, so
no.
It wasn't like as obvious. But if it was in People magazine, it would have been. So, yeah, it's just like the level of scrutiny that we put on certain people. The words we use and the implications and just kind of everything about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. It's like it's almost as if we don't treat black people fairly or equally to white people.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Could be.
Bonkers idea. I just thought of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep, yep, yep. I feel like we should touch on white feminism.
Yeah. Sure, sure, sure.
Sure.
We should.
Which, sort of one way of looking at it, is an ideology that claims to speak for all women, but ignores the needs of women of color and suppresses their voices.
Yep.
And there's this article that was in Harper's Bazaar called When Feminism is White Supremacy in Heels, where she kind of goes into different things that are kind of token with white feminism.
Right.
A few of those things are tone policing, which is essentially when, you know, black people, black women, particularly with feminism, are upset and are, you know, calling for action or change. And white women are like, well, you should just, like, say it a little nicer. You catch more flies with honey than vinegar, you know?
Yeah.
Just, like, calm down. It's fine.
Yeah.
And then centering, which is something I see online a lot, which is where, like, black women are expressing where they're coming from and how they're feeling, and white women make it about themselves. It's kind of like the all lives matter of white feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I'm on this Facebook group that's like Nasty Women or something. It's like kind of a feminist space. And there was an article that was critical about white women, and it was talking about, you know, how more than not voted for Trump and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's just all these white women in the comments being like, I'm not like that.
Yeah.
It's just, this isn't about you.
Right.
And all that jazz.
And the onus of, like, black women to then have to, like, assuage these women and be like, no, of course, no,
yeah,
not you.
More emotional labor on black women.
Yeah.
And then there's, she also touches on white savior complex, is what it sounds like, where white women just kind of, anytime they're, which is kind of similar to centering, but when they're kind of, when someone brings up the ways in which white people and white women are problematic, they just talk about all the wonderful things they've done for black people.
Yeah.
And how wonderful they are and what great people and
Has anyone seen The Help?
Yeah.
What about Green Book?
Yeah. What about...
What about...
Pause for 45 minutes.
Like,
yeah.
Lots of films.
It's important when... as a white woman and thinking about feminism and racial justice, to listen first to people of color. And if you disagree, take a step back, take a minute.
Yeah.
And shut your mouth, probably.
Probably. Best course of action.
Learn a thing.
Really think before you decide to offer a rebuttal.
Yeah, because, like, it's probably been said before, it's probably not original, it's probably not correct.
Yeah.
So, it's not your fault. I'm sure you come from Texas and you have a different grasp on history.
Yeah. It's just having, and I think, again, this is why public education, like, learning this stuff earlier in a way that is just educational and doesn't, you know, if you're young enough, you're not really going to feel as, like, threatened, I think, as, like, older people do once you've, like, really solidified your beliefs. But I remember in middle school and high school feeling, like, defensive on my own behalf about my own beliefs when they were being challenged, or just, like, things that I didn't think were... I hadn't seen, so I was sort of like, well,
I haven't seen it, and I didn't do anything.
I didn't do anything, and does that mean that what I have is, like, not, I don't deserve it?
Mm-hmm.
And what my U.S. history teacher said was, like, yeah, you don't deserve it. I mean, like, you actually don't.
Right.
That's kind of part of the point. And it's just sort of, like, getting smacked in the face, but... in a good way.
Yeah, sometimes you need to get smacked in the face, metaphorically.
You need a teacher to tell you that, like, the wealth that you personally are enjoying as, like, a 17-year-old in a wealthy suburb is, like, not something that you deserve.
You didn't earn it.
Yeah.
People that don't have it aren't not deserving of it.
Right.
And you're not deserving of it. And,
right. And you shouldn't react defensively to that. It's just a reality.
Yeah, it's people get so defensive, which I understand the instinct, but it's just, it's, you know, white people have had, especially white men, have seen themselves as the heroes and the protagonists and the news anchors and the presidents and all this shit. Not women, but and I think with that, there's just this assumption and this idea that, like, oh, yeah, this is just how it is. And there's this also this idea that, like, white is the standard.
Yeah.
You know, the assumption. And then anything else is different.
Yeah. When you said white is the standard, this is something that occasionally I'll just think about and be like, wow, I can't believe that happened and mm-hmm. is still happening just as, like, in everyday life. But when there was the crayon called skin color.
Yeah.
And it was just, like, white.
Mm-hmm.
And then
Band-Aids.
Band-Aids. And the idea of, like, the color nude mm-hmm. is, like, nude for who? I mean, yeah.
White people.
Yeah. So it's just all mm-hmm. those, the ways that we've
everyday
termed
things. And, like, it's gotten, like, even, looking at makeup, like, there are so many brands, and it's gotten better with, like, people like Rihanna and brands coming out with more colors. But, like, for so long, and with some brands now today, there's, like, you'll have these foundations, they're, like, 20 different shades of white, and then, like, two black shades.
Yeah.
You know? It's like there's just as much of a diversity in black skin as in white skin.
Yeah.
And black women and men like makeup, too. And,
right.
You know, it's those. Because we're talking about a lot of, like, sort of big picture issues, but there's also these, like, day-to-day things that, you know, lead to weathering, to...
Yes, you're reading my mind. You're
get into it, girl. Yes. Oh, we're such good allies.
Oh, my gosh, we're in sync.
God, white saviors. Where's my
cookie?
Have
you heard of our podcast where we just do a really fantastic job?
I'm gonna need a cookie.
Yeah, gross. But I mean, I think I only learned about the term weathering mm-hmm. like last year when we were researching this, or 2 years ago, which is basically like the fact that the wear and tear of racism on the body and soul mm-hmm. actually leads to earlier deaths on average for both black men and women,
mm-hmm.
The stress and the strain, and that would obviously comprise the systemic stuff,
mm-hmm.
the just casual, like, violence and all of the shit like that, and the daily stuff that just makes it harder to exist as a person.
Yeah, and it can be inherited, you know, like, you can, like, genetically, you can, if you have a parent who's gone through all this shit, you are more likely to be anxious, to have mental health problems, all these things. It's just, it's so fucked up. And there's this thing I saw, which I feel like bears repeating, where, you know, people talk about mental illness as, they like talk about that as, like, the cause of shootings.
Yeah.
Right? And, black women are the least likely to commit a mass shooting and have the least access to mental health care. Ugh. White men, it's the opposite. So it's just...
That's such a good point.
Just like little sidebar.
Ugh.
Like, black women aren't shooting up fucking malls and movie theaters and all these things. That's in churches and synagogues. That's white dudes.
Yeah. Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And didn't we read something about how, like, it was, like, a study done with, like, black and white men, and black men poop less?
Yeah, the poop study.
The poop study. I meant to look that up, but.
Yeah, you heard about this and told me about it. It's, like, black people poop the least and white men poop the most. And there's just sort of the scale that kind of, like, coincides with other discriminatory things.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Just like,
I wish I had remembered to, like, look that up before this.
Yeah. But. Just, like, white men just be fucking pooping. Just, like, casual. I'm gonna shit again today. I'm gonna go on Reddit and sit on the toilet for 45 minutes.
It's called my Reddit regular.
Get out. I'm leaving the studio. Which is a blanket draped over chairs on a table in your kitchen. Fuck it up. Was there anything else you wanted to kind of discuss together before you do kind of a back and forth and
some quick
little racist things?
I think
All right.
Let's do a little back and forth.
Cool. Racism in hiring. So white racists are always like, just get a job, get a better job, 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 job. So there are researchers that sort of looked into racial discrimination in terms of the U.S. labor market. And so what they did, what their study was, is they randomly assigned identical resumes that either had black sounding or white sounding names. Mm-hmm. And they looked at the impact on who got called in for an interview from the employer. These are all fake people, the same exact thing, just a black sounding or white sounding name. And they figured out, surprise, racism, that resumes that had white sounding names received 50% more callbacks than those with black sounding names, which, ta-da, indicates that everything else being equal, racial discrimination exists in America.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, my God. And that's the same for Airbnb. Had to change their policies because people were renting less to people who either had a profile picture that was black or if their name sounded like racial, they were just getting declined.
Yeah. You don't sound white.
I think that policy only changed. Airbnb like changed their policy slightly maybe last year or 2 years ago where they were like, look, community, this is fucked up.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just...
Yeah, like getting cabs, all kinds of...
just things where you just...
Yeah.
Yeah, bad. Yep.
Bad news bears.
Bad. Following up on the housing discrimination, just a definition. I want to define redlining because we use it a lot, but it's to refuse a loan or insurance to someone because they live in an area deemed to be a poor financial risk. And so just going into the idea of like a poor financial risk, it's the perfect euphemism for the government to deny loans or to justify giving resources to some people and not other people. The Supreme Court did rule that the segregationist policies that we were talking about with the New Deal were unconstitutional, but that was only in the late 40s after the damage was done, and we now have the modern racial wealth gaps that we talked about. But one of the terms for these segregationist policies were called racial covenants, and it was like part of underwriting standards to discourage home loans. And this quote kind of was like gross to me. In areas, quote, infiltrated by inharmonious racial or nationality groups. And so that rationale of the government protecting their investment and those of white peoples against African Americans, you know, that was like the legal underpinning of redlining, of legal redlining. And then, of course, there was all the insidious or not so insidious redlining after the 40s. But like it was legal and that was the language. So just kind of wanted to kind of touch on the racial covenants and the, you know, that vocab.
Yeah, fair enough. Fucked up.
Fucked up.
Turning over to the medical field. Yeah. University of Virginia researchers quizzed white medical students and white residents on different sort of beliefs about differences between the races that are not true. For instance, that black people have less sensitive nerve endings than white people.
Wow.
Or that black people have thicker skin, like literally have thicker skin.
What?
And half of these people thought that at least one of the false statements was true, with the most of that half believing that black people's skin is just thicker.
What?
Yeah. And those who held those false beliefs tended to rate black patients' pain as lower than that of white patients with the same complaints. And black patients received painkillers less than white patients. There was a paper that found that black children with appendicitis were less likely to receive pain meds than their white counterpart. That's kids. Physicians are more likely to underestimate the pain of black patients. And at a hospital ER in Atlanta, 74% of white patients with bone fractures got painkillers compared to only 50% of black patients. And we've mentioned this before, but I'll just repeat it. Black women's babies die at twice the rate of white women's, and black women die at four times the rate of white women. And that's, again, controlling for income and education. So,
yeah,
can't even receive the same health care.
That's awful. And to repeat the incredibly gross statistic about maternal, you know, mortality, black women die at a higher rate than when slavery was happening.
Yeah.
Because as property, that they were like a more valued commodity. Mm-hmm. It's just like really, cool. Really, is that really where we want to be in 2020?
When our government like sterilized tons of black women, and still today, black women are offered sterilization as an option at a wildly higher rate than white women.
It's just no.
Ugh. Those are my racist things.
Yeah. Student loan debt by race is a huge thing. It's experienced differently for different borrower groups. The typical white male borrower has paid off 44% of his student loan debt within 12 years of graduating, while the typical black female borrower has actually seen her balance grow by 13%. And there are, you know, more black children drop out of college by a much larger degree because it's for a variety of reasons. A black college graduate owes $7,400 more on average than their white peers as they the moment they graduate, and there is huge differences in interest accrual, leading to black graduates owing a lot more after graduation. There's a whole lot of kind of statistical analysis of the way student loan debt affects black and white students differently. That's worth just kind of worth Googling, because it's kind of just like basically everything that you could think of is like, well, it's worse for black people. And then another thing that I actually was just reading about today, which is sort of gross, is student loan debt actually drives military enrollment now more, because people are looking for a public education that the military would provide if they enroll, different forgivenesses of debt. And as Pod Save the People was talking about, I think also today, just the idea that you're joining the military as a last resort, and it's really just like a false choice that's been created, because the people that the military is recruiting to be on active duty are only really enlisting because they're hoping to get an education that they can pay for, and this is the only way, or they really just have no other options. So student loan debt actually drives military enrollment, and Pod Save the People made the point that like we probably don't need a draft now because we have this like system, like the market is basically just like forcing people into this like faux draft. A certain segment of the population. Yeah.
Not if you have bone spurs.
Not if you have bone spurs.
And then my last little data point that we mentioned briefly at some point, but I think bears repeating, is that there are more black people in jail today than there were in slavery in 1850. And of course that black people are more often convicted and are sentenced more harshly than their white counterparts for the same crimes. So it's essentially modern day slavery.
Yeah. And that again, and we've talked about it in the past, and we should talk about it again. There are the modern day slavery extends to a lot of different things. There actually are essentially debtors' prisons at this point. I think they're called restitution homes or restitution centers, where you can, if you have like a quote unquote low level of debt, which is under maybe like $7,000, you can like be put up in these gross motels and work off these debts, but you don't really, there's no transparency about when you've worked it off or how much further you have to go, and like people steal it from you, and like you have to pay rent at this like debtor's prison, so what are you even doing?
It's awful.
But yeah, in terms of police violence, and we've talked about this, there was an investigation by Arizona Central, and they talked about police violence in Phoenix. 1 in 5 homicides in the city were committed by the police. And they talk about police union contracts, where at least in Arizona, and I think it is like this in a lot of different places, every 3 years, police officers can have their conduct record purged and sent to an inactive facility where even the police department doesn't have access to it. And the city can't do any analysis of police violence because, or on like predictive like policing, and HR doesn't have access to it, and I think Arizona Central got access to it, and I don't even know how they did, but there were 600 incidents of like misconduct reported to the police, and 90% of all sustained complaints were erased. So police union contracts remain completely like very strong, kind of ironclad. And so it's hard to really know the extent of police violence. And that's because of the strength of their unions. And so when we contrast that with the way that we've defanged like student, teacher, like unions of, you know, other workers in this country, it's really galling to me that like the one that's really held up is police unions. And I also have in my notes, without sourcing, so, but hopefully it's true. But I have that the NYPD use of force policy is more restrictive on when police can shoot a dog than a person.
Wow.
And then I said, woof, no pun intended.
Yes, to that. And it's like, yeah, you shouldn't shoot a dog, but like you shouldn't shoot a person. And why are we valuing, you know, dog lives above, you know, black people's lives?
Yeah.
Not super great.
No.
Quite literally the definition of dehumanizing.
Yeah, there are so many ways that the police can, like, fuck with you through the institutions that already protect them.
And yeah, all the loopholes.
Yeah.
They're sort of protecting one another and lying and planting evidence and all kinds of things.
Yeah. And then the wording of the laws and the wording of things that they can and can't do, like chokeholds versus strangleholds. Like, one is like restricting the airway and one's restricting the muscles. Do you really trust every single NYPD officer to know the difference and
no,
be able to, like...
Certainly don't.
No. So...
And people have died because of that.
Yes.
You can't breathe, so.
Yeah.
All right.
Fun. Just, you know, nonstop fun and lightness. But for Martin Luther King Day, this is sort of, we wanted to spend, you know, the majority of the episode just, I guess just, you know.
Just highlighting things.
Yeah.
That are happening and... You know,
real.
Providing data. And,
yeah.
Because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think there are a lot of white people who are just like, wow, you know, black people just are criminals, or they just don't try, or they're just not as smart, or they don't feel pain. Their skin's so thick. You know, just all these dangerously false ideas.
Yeah, and I would highly, highly recommend the podcast Pod Save the People, which is hosted by Deray McKesson, who's a Black Lives Matter activist, and Brittany Packnett, and Clint Smith III, and Samson Yangwe. And they are, one of them is like an academic, one of them's a statistician, and then another is just, I think, she's a writer, and she just became an MSNBC commentator, so we'll see her more, which I'm excited about.
Yay!
But they're really great, and they will give you so much to think about. on the weekly.
Love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now for We See You.
Yep. Alrighty, so this We See You was sparked by a Facebook comment on a friend's post where a guy was saying he wouldn't vote for anyone but Bernie in the general election because he believed Warren was lying about Sanders, saying a woman couldn't get elected, and he hated all the other candidates for various reasons. Mm. So back in the 2016 election, one in 10 Bernie primary or caucus supporters did not vote for Clinton in the general election. Some of them didn't vote at all, some of them voted for Trump, some of them wrote someone in. And now, fast forward to 2020, we have hashtag Never Warren becoming a movement from these charming individuals, despite the fact that many of these people, mostly white men, claimed in 2016 that they would be down for a female candidate like Elizabeth Warren specifically, just not Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And I do understand why someone would like Sanders' platform and would support him as a candidate, and I also understand it's disappointing and frustrating when your candidate does not get the nomination, particularly when it feels like the political system is broken. However, elections in this country are not abstract philosophical debates. They have real human consequences. And the consequence from 2016 is the election of fucking Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He's lied over 16,000 times while in office, has separated parents and children at the border and put them in cages, has rolled back environmental protections in the midst of a climate crisis, has interacted dangerously and petulantly with a number of world leaders, cozied up with dictators, disrespected our allies, has consistently displayed his racism, misogyny, homophobia, and transphobia, has publicly broken laws, so many more. I can go on and on. He's just all around been like a caricature of a cartoon villain brought to life. And if Sanders does not get the nomination and Bernie or Busters abstain from voting for the Democratic nominee a second time, who knows what irreparable damage will be done to our country and its citizens and the rest of the fucking world. Perhaps because these stakes are lowest for white men as the most privileged class in our country, these voters either don't see the impact of their action or inaction, or they don't give a shit, or they believe there is some moral superiority in their fruitless, toxic political tantrums.
Woo!
Right? I was mad when I wrote this. Yeah, you like I knew you'd
like
that.
Love it.
Ooh, I was angry. So it is the moral choice to do what is best for the greater good, regardless of what the incels on Reddit are screaming. We see you, privileged ass Bernie or Busters.
Ugh, we see you.
So mad. We're so mad about them.
Oh my God. And good for you for taking one of them on the Facebook.
I did, and he stopped responding, so I think I won.
Yeah. Ugh, ugh. And he included like basically just like a college freshman level quote, like,
oh my God.
Won't engage with evil if they're both evil. Like, oh, compromise. It's just like, jump in a river.
Dumb, honestly. It took everything from that. She's like, go fuck yourself. So I had my monthly internet argument.
Yeah. Oh my God. Good for you.
Thanks. I should send him this.
Yeah.
Following up, circling back.
Many thanks. All right, so my first We See You is to the New York Times op-ed board. So every election cycle, the New York Times op-ed board endorses a presidential candidate. And this cycle, they've endorsed Warren and Klobuchar. You may wonder why my We See You revolves around the board of a paper I greatly respect when they picked my top candidate. Well, I can always find
Klobuchar.
Something. Yeah. Can always find something to be cranky about. Mm-hmm. But in the past, these board deliberations have been private. And this year, when they pulled back the curtain, it wasn't cute. It gives me a much better understanding of the gaping void between the op-ed column and the New York Times newsroom. This op-ed board came off as smug, stuffy, patrician, and condescending. While some smart questions were asked of all the candidates, the majority of the questions fell flat or were problematic in some way and had me rooting for every candidate, even Buttigieg and Sanders, and I wanted them all to just own this group of people. And in the analysis portion where the candidates were removed and it was just the board, the tone of the commentary was disappointing. I wasn't exactly sure what this editorial board was actually looking for or getting at. And what was really the nail in the coffin was that there were some female members of the board who were actually posing the sexist questions of likability and commenting things like, what men don't like for sure is to be lectured by a woman. Ugh. Oh. Yeah. if I wasn't already feeling dark and defeatist, having to watch the candidate I love and think is clearly the most qualified, and then the candidate I love the second most and is clearly the most innovative, authentic, and sharp, Yang, get cut down and ignored respectively, this certainly put me there. I better understand why this group of people have no problem publishing op-eds by racist dunces like David Brooke or pseudo-liberal moderates with an unpopularly flippant hot take like Barry Weiss and Maureen Dowd. And Brooks, in case anyone needs a reminder, wrote a December 27th column called The Secret of Jewish Genius, in which he cited and linked to a widely debunked paper that examines Ashkenazi intellect based on genetics. And one of the study's authors, Henry Harpending, is a known white supremacist. So, and due to the column's backlash, the editors had to remove the reference and then had to issue this whole backpedaling, saying that he wasn't endorsing the study or the author's views, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, and this guy's also a climate skeptic. Fun, but I digress. The point is, I now understand why these people, like, seem to enjoy having this sort of, like, ivory tower kind of, like, their ivory tower fun, where they sort of, like, throw something like this out there, and they're like, let's just see what happens in the crackling marketplace of ideas. When it's like, actually, we're all in the middle of an incredibly important and shitty, like, primary, and your stupid questions and positing are just, like, not helpful. Anyway, my last big issue is the fact that they picked two people. They picked a change maker and a moderate, and they threw up their hands saying ultimately it's for the American people to decide which way to go. Picking a radical and a moderate, for lack of better terms, is akin to not picking anyone. It's the closest they could get to really not taking a stance. What might have been better is for them to just not issue an endorsement or to wait. If they were going to go the unprecedented route, there were other ways to make a statement. So peering into this process wasn't pretty, and that's even knowing that they decided to ultimately endorse Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar, two women. I could be happy, but I'm just really not. Something about this whole process of endorsements by the New York Times left me with a really bad taste in my mouth. So because of this internalized misogyny from the women on the panel, the smug tone, the final decision to endorse two candidates who stand for two opposite ways that the party could go, It's a disappointment. The whole thing landed with a sputter, and sputters will not do in this election cycle. They just won't. We see you.
Yeah, that's right. Alrighty. In a truly what the fuck move, Amtrak attempted to charge two individuals who use electric wheelchairs $25,000 for two seats on a two-hour train ride from Chicago to Bloomington. Everyone else on the train was able to purchase tickets for $16.
Ugh.
I'm not a mathematician, but that's a hell of a lot less than $25,000.
Oh my God.
For that money, they literally could have bought a car to get to their destination. Amtrak said the high cost was due to the fact that to accommodate these wheelchairs, they would need to remove from some seating from the dining area, and somehow that cost them $25,000. So this is not only beyond unreasonable, it is illegal. The ADA is a civil rights law, and it prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities in jobs, schools, public places, and transportation, like trains. It requires companies like Amtrak to make accommodations so that people with disabilities have comparable access to transportation as do people without disabilities. So even if it somehow costs Amtrak $25,000 to make those seat adjustments, which, like, how? I don't know.
Oh, my God. That is ridiculous.
Yeah, even if somehow it does cost their company that money, they made $3.3 billion last year and should build costs like this into their budget or update their trains to accommodate electric wheelchairs without having to remove seating prior
update
to trips.
Update your trains.
Yeah, update your trains. Figure something out. And then, so there's kind of a happy ending to this, we see you. After media attention, Amtrak said they wouldn't be charging the $25,000, but
well,
this should have never happened in the first place. And one of the men that was going to go on the train is like a sort of a disability rights advocate. So it's like he knew the channels to go and kind of how to get here. But if he hadn't, these people probably just would not have been able to get to their destination at all. So we see you, Amtrak. Get your shit together.
$25,000 for an Amtrak train ride.
Wait, was there a typo? They're like, no. $16, $25,000 for 2 hours on a train.
Oh my God, Amtrak, what a bad look, seriously. Mm-hmm. Oh, my we see you is for a TSA agent. It feels like they're always doing something.
They're
like,
always up to no good.
There's, you could always probably Google like TSA agent and check the most recent news for a we see you.
Oh.
So a security guard has had to apologize to Native American activist Tara Huska after this inspector pulled her hair and said, giddy up. She had two braids down her back. And yeah. So this was in the Minneapolis airport when this incident took place. And Tara said, you know, my hair is part of my spirit. I am Native American. It was humiliating. My braids are not reins. She is also a prominent activist and lawyer returning from a climate march. So she also kind of knows how to get some attention for when something like this happens. She's a member of the Ojibwe tribe and, you know, the TSA agent was checking her braids for weapons, like, okay. But yeah, instead of just a standard check, they were pulled behind her shoulders and this woman was laughing as she snapped them and said, giddy up. Anyway, she got an apology from this woman and from TSA broadly. And I'm glad that she felt that there was a good resolution to this. But let's just treat others like we'd like to be treated. If you're one of those people who says, I wouldn't mind if my hair was touched in jest at TSA, then I'll add a slightly more specific plea. Please don't touch people you don't know in public. Like, and if you're a TSA agent, do not abuse your position of power and authority to humiliate travelers. Even if you think it's like something funny that everyone's going to enjoy, like, think twice. Just like we were saying about, rebutting someone who's trying to tell you something about their experience that would be just inherently different than yours. Everyone in line at TSA is already vulnerable enough when we're traveling, and an action like that is so deeply disrespectful and thoughtless and just around all around a pile of trash. I can't imagine if someone grabbed my hair at TSA. It just like, it would... I would be so embarrassed and angry, and I'd also feel like I couldn't even get mad because, you know, we're all just meaningless, like, ants to them. But we can do so much better. Just think twice. Just think for 1 second before you literally reach out and pull someone's hair in public. My God, it's ridiculous that this even has to be said. We see you.
Yes. All right, we turn our attention now to the National Archives. Their mission, as they report, is for, quote, Americans to claim their rights of citizenship, hold their government accountable, and understand their history so they can participate more effectively in their government. Sounds good, except that they decided to begin engaging in censorship, which is kind of the opposite of what a historical archive should be doing. They altered photos of the 2017 Women's March to remove the words vagina and pussy from protest signs, as well as altering signs that were critical of Trump. Two of the signs said God hates Trump, and the other one said Trump and GOP hands off women. Now they say God hates, that's it, and GOP hates women. The God hates sign in particular now has a completely different message. And the rationale for editing the signs is not to engage in current political controversy. But by censoring these signs, they're engaging in a different way and they're attempting to rewrite history. Two other signs, which initially said, if my vagina could shoot bullets, it'd be less regulated, and this pussy grabs back, had the words vagina and pussy blurred out. And again, the National Archives said this was because children will be visiting the museum, but children should probably be okay with the fact that some people have vaginas. Like,
yeah,
about half of people have vaginas.
This is a political protest. Just pick other pictures.
If you're that worried about it.
Yeah.
But, like, vagina is not a dirty word. It's like a human body part. Let's all calm down. Anyway, we see you to whoever the fuck at the National Archives made this poor judgment call.
That is so disappointing.
It's scary.
That's really scary.
Soviet, yeah.
Yeah, that's very, very, very upsetting.
Spooky,
fuck
spooky.
That. My, we see you. Washington State, I found out we are actually one of 14 states that don't have a parole board right now. We got rid of it in the 80s when there was a Republican-dominated Congress.
Gross.
Yay. And kind of going back, touching briefly on our broader topic for the week, racial disparities in the Washington prison population reflect that of like the national discrepancies. African Americans make up 4.1% of the population in Washington and 18.4% of its prison inmates. And a full 28% of those are serving life without parole. This shift away from parole was in line with Reagan's national movement to adopt a tough on crime policy. Rehabilitation no longer became an option. We moved towards longer sentences, mandatory minimums, life without parole. Washington's prison population skyrocketed again, along with the national prison population numbers. It's grown from about 500,000 people in 1984 to 1.5 million today. We as a country have the highest incarceration rate in the world, and I would encourage everyone to see Ava DuVernay's The 13th, but hey, this is Washington specific, and I didn't know that we were such a big part of the problem. When we got rid of parole, we installed the Indeterminate Sentences Review Board, which sounds terrible and just like inefficient. The name just sounds like stoic and inefficient. And it's a panel run by the Department of Corrections that refuse only three types of cases: certain sex offenses committed on or after September 1st, 2001, cases involving juveniles sentenced as adults, and any crimes committed before 1984. So that's actually pretty narrow scope and doesn't apply to a lot of people, including a lot of people serving life sentences. And so those people just don't really have a chance for parole. Their only chance for reprieve is through the Clemency and Pardons Board, which holds between 2 and 3 dozen hearings per year. And that's about a quarter of the petitions they receive. And then only a very small percentage receive any type of clemency. And when the Washington Parole Board was in effect, they held about 5,000 hearings per year. So there's a new law in Washington State House of Representatives. It's SB 5819, establishing a post-conviction review board. And so in an effort to be a better citizen, I'm going to call my state senator and see what's being done about this bill to move it forward. It seems that Washington desperately needs a new review board that convenes more frequently with an eye towards restorative justice and clemency. So Washington State, we see you.
Mm-hmm. I'll call too.
Yeah.
All right, a good thing. Shoop, boop, boop, boop. I mean, the NFL sucks and has problems with women, but that aside, the 49ers are headed to the Super Bowl, and that's not the good thing for this. But Katie Sowers, who is the 49ers assistant coach, is going to be the first woman and the first openly LGBTQ coach to head to the Super Bowl.
Yay!
So that's pretty awesome. And she's only the second woman in history to hold a full-time coaching position with the NFL.
Awesome.
So that's lovely. And she had a sweet quote where she said, "When I'm on the field and look around, it all kind of sinks in how far I've come and where I am. I see young girls out there almost every game, and someone's mom or dad is yelling to me saying, 'My daughter wants to play football,' or 'My daughter's going to be a coach.' And those are the moments where it's worth it." Yeah, and she played football in college, and then she was turned down from her college football team for an unpaid volunteer coaching job because it was a Catholic school, essentially Catholic college.
Great.
And because she was gay, she just wasn't allowed. So
look at her now.
So yay, women.
Yay.
LGBTQ people.
Good, good.
BUF NFL, go Niners.
Cool, cool, cool.
Yeah. So yeah, good thing.
Yay. Yay.
End it there.
I know. Before we start descending into criticisms.
Yeah, like, you know, men in the NFL could just assault women.
All right, cool.
Good thing. Yay. We'll see you next year. I guess we won't see you, but you'll hear us.
You'll hear us.